Welcome to the Future Law Podcast, the show that looks at where the law has been and where it's going. I'm Mike Madison. I'm a law professor in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, with 35 years in the legal sector. Last season, we talked about legal tech. This season, we're covering ALSPs, the sector of the legal industry called alternative legal services providers, even though to a growing number of people, they're not alternatives any longer. Maybe they're not the future of law at this point. Maybe they're the present as well. ALSPs come in lots of types and sizes, from broad to narrow and from large to small, but where aren't they advancing? In this episode, I talk with my longtime friend, John Harris, who leads a boutique civil practice in New York City. He's a veteran, successful trial lawyer who has some choice things to say about how legal tech and ALSPs are not necessarily keys to some areas of law. John Harris, welcome to the Future Law Podcast. It is a delight to have you on the show.
Mike, nice to be here. Great to be here with you.
So you are the managing partner of Harris, St. Laurent, and Wexler. I think I got the names pronounced correctly. A boutique law firm, private law firm in New York City. That's your current role, but we've known each other for close to 40 years at this point, having gone to law school together. So you've had quite the career in private practice and other things before launching your firm in 2009. Tell everybody briefly what your practice is, what the firm's specialty is.
We are a 20-person employment, litigation, and white-collar defense boutique in New York City. We probably have the best practice in New York City for high-end employment matters.
Okay, so a very, very niche, specialized practice. So the first thing I want to do with you is I want to put you on the spot and ask you to look into a crystal ball, because this is a podcast about the future and the future of law. And from where you sit in your firm and with your practice area, where do you see the future of law going?
So from our firm's standpoint, right, we're not talking about big law, I'm not talking about government, just talking about our firm. We are an extremely bespoke practice. We represent a lot of individuals, probably 70%+ of our clients are individuals. The cases are unique, and I don't really see the practice going very much in the way of a change. And what I always say to people is, I think you could dig Cicero up from his grave, wherever it is in Rome, teach him how to use the computer, the iPhone, and a few other modern interfaces, teach him a little bit about modern finance, and he would be ready to roll.
So let's dig into that a little bit, because that's a pretty provocative statement, like Cicero in the 21st century. What do you mean by that?
I mean, what we do is not removed from what Cicero did or what Abraham Lincoln did or what other people have done for thousands of years, hundreds and thousands of years, which is we largely represent individuals who are adverse to a large institution, be it the government, a large bank, a major company, a hedge fund. The weight of that institution wishes to come down upon them in some way negative towards them. And we act to protect their interests, and we act to further their interests, and we act to right injustices that are being done to them by those large institutions. And I don't see these large institutions going away. If anything, you see them becoming bigger. I don't see their use of power changing very much. Seems to be a pretty much a steady state that when you acquire power as a large institution that you like to use it. And I don't see people's willingness to fight back or take on that power changing very much. And so I think that the institutions we have here, the court systems, the arbitration systems, the venues that folks have to address their circumstances with these institutions, I just see that continuing on.
So do you want to translate that for us down into the nitty-gritty of what you and your colleagues do on a day-to-day basis? Is this litigation and arbitration in a way that we've developed and known it over the last 40 or 50 years? Is it predominantly trial work? Is it what's the mix of skills and activities that the firm engages in?
So let's say you're the founder, you're the co-founder of a company. Let's say you raise a lot of money at a large valuation. And let's say your co-founder or the board of the company decides that you're no longer needed. All right. Thank you very much for playing. This company wouldn't be here if not for you, but we don't need you anymore. Thank you. Please ride off into the sunset. And we're not going to offer you anything. Okay. So what are the tools at our disposal? Our tools are human persuasion. Hey, that's not the way you should treat the co-founder of your company, right? That's not market. So human persuasion, right? Our tools are psychological, obviously. What's going on with somebody who's just been thrown out of a company that created? What are the people on the other side of the table thinking? Our tool is the threat of arbitration, right? Or a court action. We have mediation as a tool, and we have the press as a tool. Our firm is not a huge user of the press. There are other firms that are in our business that are larger users of the press, but certainly the press and social media are tools in what's going on here.
So a big theme of the podcast has been the changing character of the economy, the changing character of the legal profession, the need for modern lawyers to be technologically literate and adapt with AI is coming and data science is coming and all of these things. It sounds like very little of that has affected the meat and potatoes of your practice.
Look, this is Old Testament stuff. You form a business with your co-founder. You go out and you go raise $75 million from some very well-heeled venture capitalists in Palo Alto and New York and Asia, and you decide that you don't need your co-founder around anymore. You know, we call that betrayal. You can, of course, only be betrayed by someone you trust. And that's just Old Testament stuff. And, you know, it's not a matter of AI. It's not a matter of machine learning or anything like that. It's a matter of that's interpersonal relations with, you know, look, there's definitely economics mixed in. There's stock options, there's founder shares, there's other things like that. The company itself may be engaged in some really cool AI type project or something like that. But this is just old school.
It reminds me of cases that I worked on as a lawyer in Palo Alto 30 years ago, which had essentially the same dynamic, right? Founders get tossed out if they're not appropriately protected contractually when their entrepreneurial utility has been exhausted and somebody else wants to take over. And I practiced in a very analog era, late 80s, early 90s, compared to the way most of the law practice today is stereotyped.
It's unchanged. Or somebody is, the government decides to investigate some large organization because the government thinks there's some antitrust violation or securities violation or something like that. So a group of senior people at the organization get together, they sit around a conference room table and they decide that Timmy's the bad guy, right? And then Timmy gets fired. Timmy gets handed to the regulators on a silver platter. It's a bad day for Timmy, right? And we represent Timmy, right? Usually in that situation. And, you know, again, that's just old school.
As you're describing it, it's reminding me of a Humphrey Bogart movie. Right? Somebody's going over and you're there to keep that from happening or to soften the blow. Right. So let me ask you a little bit about the lawyers you work with, right? So when you're recruiting colleagues, do you look for sort of certain types of skills or personalities to do this kind of practice? Or is this sort of a standard kind of private law practice that just continues to be important and thriving despite all of the sort of market trajectory aiming people into tech-oriented stuff?
So the big thing that we've done is we've aimed for a multidisciplinary practice. What do I mean by that? So we got 20 lawyers at the firm, right? Often the last thing we need on a matter is another lawyer. So we have a clinical forensic psychologist who we work with very closely. She helps us work with our clients. She helps us think about what the other folks might be thinking. She helps us think about what a juror or an arbitrator might be thinking, right? So we work very closely with her. We work very closely with folks who understand the economics of the underlying businesses. The situations we work with, we handle a lot of cases on Wall Street. We have a lot of institutional knowledge about how the various desks on Wall Street and the businesses on Wall Street work. You know, that's very important to us to understand that somebody who's a trader at a hedge fund is in a very different environment than someone who's an investment banker at a major bank. Some people would say they're both bankers, but they're in very different businesses. They're paid differently. The ethics are different. The morals are different. The economics are different. The contracts are different. The disputes are different, right? The investigations are different. So we have a lot there. And the area we've been moving is people with industry expertise and people with multidisciplinary backgrounds.
How's the shape of that team and how has the collection of expertise evolved since you founded the firm? What's changed over the last dozen, 15 years for you?
So we were much more a straight up law firm. We are still a straight up law firm. I mean, that's what we do. We're lawyers. But basically everybody at the firm had backgrounds that looked a little bit more alike. They'd gone to law school. Maybe they'd clerked. Maybe they'd gone to a big firm. Most of them had learned to try a case somewhere. Okay. And now we drop them into our practice. Our practice now is much more, hey, maybe the person went to law school, but maybe the person also knows a lot about how Wall Street works through their career or experience. Maybe the person didn't go to law school, right? Maybe they have a background in economics or in finance, and they're going to help us with the business side of the case. Or maybe they have, like Monica Delgado is a forensic psychologist who has worked within the legal system for 20 plus years. And maybe she can help our client understand how this process is going to play out for the next 2.5 years if we don't settle and if we go through this case, and help them make a better decision about whether to settle or fight, right? And we make much more use of mediators, a much, much higher use of mediators, particularly mediators with relevant industry experience.
Interesting. So how has this experience, you know, founding the firm, running the firm, evolving the firm over the last dozen, 15 years, how has that in your mind been a continuation of your professional career to that point, and how has it departed from your prior experience and expectations?
So the continuation is on the case side. I had a large arbitration earlier this year where we got a very good result. That is against a major hedge fund. That's a direct continuation of the things I've done since I was 25 years old and just took a job clerking, right? Learning how to try a case, deal with evidence, handle witnesses, put together a case, cross-examine witnesses. The part of the business that has been discontinuous, right, is that running a 20-odd person law firm, right? We are a lot like running a small entrepreneurial business, right? And we are also a lot like running McDonald's. In the sense of, we have all the problems that someone running a McDonald's has. Employees get sick, employees have problems, government regulations change, right? And you got to make sure your computer systems work and your phones work. And so, you know, while you think it's a really intellectual event, right, or it's a high powered event, you know, there are days you're just trying to get your internet to work, right?
You got to deliver the quarter pounders, or you got to make sure that the milkshake machine works. The notorious Achilles heel of the modern McDonald's is the milkshake machine.
Yeah. And then it's been fascinating because we get to build what we want to build. You know, so when I say we want to be more multidisciplinary, that's 100% within our control.
So what is it that you're trying to build? Somebody sort of put you on the spot with sort of what's the vision of where this goes for you?
Let me do it by what's not. Sometimes you try a case, we try a case against a large law firm, and they have 10 people on the case, and they're all lawyers, and they all have the exact same background. And I'm kind of like, what's the point? You're only going to have 2 or 3 people speak in court. Why do you need 7 people who are replicants of the 3 people talking in court? So my vision of the firm is, you know, if you're going to have a trial team or a team of people, you know, hey, let's have a really good lawyer, right? Let's have somebody who's skilled at the graphical presentation of evidence. Let's have somebody who's skilled from a psychological perspective. Let's have somebody who knows the industry. All right. Let's have that team try the case.
What about junior people? So let's suppose that somebody listening to this podcast with you and hearing you talk about McDonald's and replicants and high stakes financial litigation on behalf of the, you know, this Old Testament vision of betrayal and victim, which is a really unique, but potentially really attractive and interesting mix, right? Somebody who's in law school today hears this and says, I want to be a part of that. Like, that's a really inspiring, attractive vision. So what's your guidance?
They should email me tomorrow.
Okay.
My associate, Marilyn, she started at her firm as she's an intern. She became a paralegal. She went to law school. Last year, she tried two cases. She's now a second year. She tried two cases with me, including a case where we won $52 million.
Wow.
And she was invaluable in that case.
So there's two things I take away from that. Let me just quickly review. One is, that's a very, a word that I've started to use a lot in legal education. I start talking about what I call concierge legal education, right? So as the experience that you and I had in law school, the experience that most people have had in law school over the last century is a big batch of students, a small number of faculty, everybody gets essentially a standardized education. They get spit out at the end with a JD, might be a quality JD program, but it's essentially a kind of mass production model. And we're getting to a point in education, and you're describing a continuation of this, where it's more of a one-to-one mentorship and training kind of an experience.
We are 100% bespoke, and we are small teams.
So the other thing that I hear in that, your anecdote about your colleague, I know you were serious when you said people should email you with their interest, but how is it that people develop the skills and the competencies that makes them attractive to you if they do email you?
So Peter Drucker, Peter Drucker, the management consultant, management consultant,
yeah, sure.
After a lot of 40 years of his life trying to figure out how to motivate people, wrote this sentence that resonates with me. He goes, I finally figure out how to motivate people, hire motivated people. Yeah, we are looking for motivated people who want to learn how to practice law, want to learn how to try a case, want to learn how to handle a CEO of a client, of a company as a client in a difficult and contentious litigation, are not afraid to go up against the government, right? And we're looking for people who are willing to work hard, right? And put in the effort, and we'll meet you more than halfway.
Does it matter what kind of sort of educational experiences people have in law school?
It unquestionably is helpful at our firm if folks have taken some business-oriented courses. We represent a lot of CEOs, CFOs, traders, right? Like if the language of finance and business is totally foreign to you, that is something that you have to learn to be successful at our firm. So if you've already taken a step in that direction, it's obviously helpful.
Having been in this sector of the practice for a while and having had a lot of success, do you have a sense of how many other practices there are out there that, not copies of yours, but have this sort of analogous sense of, this sort of this old school style and set of expectations?
Yeah, anybody who's practicing criminal law, for sure. And I would think it's probably the case as well for anybody who's dealing with matrimonial law, probably has the same or those types of issues. I've never dealt in that area, so I can't say that for sure. Definitely for sure the criminal, but I would think that area as well.
So do you talk to colleagues who work in fields that have more of a sort of a sexier technology affect, where the AI and data stuff is much more present and is having a bigger impact on how they manage their practices or how they interact with clients or interact with courts?
So the real answer is I spend most of my professional friends live way more in the Old Testament world than the New Testament world. So for example, we represent one of the fellows from Coinbase who was just indicted for insider trading. And on the one hand, you could say that's a really sexy technological case. It's all about are these things securities and what's up with Coinbase and Bitcoin? And yes, that's all true. But at the end of the day, it's a criminal case.
That's incredibly helpful to me in understanding kind of the breadth of the profession as it is today, in contrast to the sort of stereotype PR that you hear a lot, that there are a lot of things out there that clearly resemble the law firm world that we knew when we graduated from law school. Let me ask you one more thing, though. Like, so you are, and I'm looking at you on the screen, we can't see you on the podcast, obviously, but I know that you're not sitting in an office in Manhattan. You are largely managing your practice from a house outside of the city, largely remote. And you've been doing that consistently and regularly since at least the beginning of the COVID pandemic and maybe earlier. I'm just wondering about how successful you've been able to manage the practice in the remote posture. To what extent this layer of tech, you know, you've been able to adapt successfully.
So I was everybody's got to be in the office 5 days a week. You got to be there at 9 a.m. Boom, boom, boom type of old school. That's like Bill Parcells, right? Boom. For those of you who may be New York Giants or Dallas Cowboy or other football fans. And I was 100% wrong. I could not have been more wrong. Again, I don't know what it'd be like to try to run a 1,000-person firm like that, because that's a different animal. But the basic principle on which we've always run our firm is treat everybody like adults. Right? Treat everybody who works at our firm like an adult. So we have a Monday morning meeting done by Zoom. Everybody in the firm, from the senior most person to the most recent staffer we just hired, is on the call. We talk about what we're going to do that week. We get organized. If people need to come into the office for a reason, we have a beautiful office they can come into. If people want to come into the office, we have a beautiful office they can come into. But if somebody's got to write a brief that day, and rather than commute in an hour from New Jersey to sit at their desk in the office and write a brief, if they'd rather do it at home and spend that extra 2 hours with their kids or working out or working on the brief or doing something else, you know, God bless, right? Just be an adult, be responsible, take care of business. And then we get together about once every 6 weeks to do a firm activity, something that is fun. Like we all got together and met up at the Bronx Botanical Gardens, or we all had a party at one of my colleagues' homes over the summer where people could bring their kids.
Okay, cool. What else? What have I not touched on that, you know, in the broad category of the future of law and future law, whether it's looking retrospectively at your career over 40 years to this moment or looking prospectively?
So the two biggest things that have really changed since I've been practicing are the growth of mediation. And I don't know if you've talked about that on your show. Obviously, cases were always mediated, but the growth of really professional men and women who mediate, you know, 100 or 200 cases a year, and who are extremely good at it and who are trusted by both parties, has been a huge change. I think when I started in this business, I might do one mediation every couple of years. It would be somebody, a client would say, hey, we got this mutual friend, both me and our adversary, maybe we should get together. But now it's an industry, it's extraordinarily useful. I find the mediators to be exceptionally useful in helping the clients, our clients, folks on the other side, look at alternatives to bludgeoning each other or in discovery or going up in front of a jury and seeing what happens, right? And really hugely valuable. The other thing, which I think is not as much a positive, is, of course, there's a huge trend in the law towards what I call private school, which is arbitration. And I like arbitration. I'm not negative on arbitration. You get very good arbitrators. I think you get a lot of very fair results. But I don't think you can be a citizen of the country or somebody interested in the legal system of this country and not understand that what arbitration really is private school for litigation. And nobody really calls it that. That's really what it is. You go to a nice place. They got a nice conference room table. They got a nice spread of food versus going down to state court which is a different experience. And we practice in state court, we practice in federal court, we practice in arbitration. We're happy practicing in any of them. I just think that I don't know that people are giving enough understanding of what's happening there.
So to kind of translate a little bit of that from in terms of the frameworks that I'm more conversant with, I'd say that you've taken, you know, the civil justice system in particular is conceived very much as an instrument of the of public order and public values through juries and other things and precedent and all of the things that kind of roll up into the rule of law. And significant chunks of those operations and functions have been curtained off or walled off into what you called private school, which I agree, I'd never heard that metaphor, but it seems very apt, where the litigants or the people who are parties to the arbitration may get what they believe is a fair outcome and a fair result at a fair price, but in a way that's isolating it from participating in the broader structure of the legal system.
Correct. Our firm handled a case this year. I'm not going to talk about the case, but we handled a case this year where a very, very highly skilled arbitrator made a very interesting ruling on an interesting issue of New York law, which is an entirely private ruling.
And is there any mechanism for even a limited appeal?
If no one appeals, right, that decision remains entirely confidential. So nobody will ever, other than the litigants themselves, no one will be able to cite it for precedent. Nobody will be able to comment on it in an article. Nobody would be able to do anything with it. If it is appealed, the appellate question is not whether the arbitrator got the issue of law right, but whether the arbitrator committed manifest disregard of the law, which I equate to, you know, taking your two fingers and poking them in the eye of the judge. Okay.
So I think we need to wrap up the conversation on that note, right? Which is that there's all kinds of interesting things going on in your practice and it's a compelling and exciting world, but there are some interesting and somewhat occasionally disturbing sort of structural drawbacks to where the nature of the disputes you're working on are pulling the system as a whole.
Which has nothing to do, for your podcast and your listeners, has nothing to do with technology.
Right.
It has to do with the willingness or eagerness or acquiescence of the courts and the legislatures to basically having a parallel system of private justice emerge.
Interesting. Well, on that note, John Harris, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you on the Future Law Podcast. I look forward to continuing to follow your firm and your practice and to seeing you again down the road and in the not too distant future.
Be well. It's been great. Take care, Mike.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Future Law Podcast. Next week, my co-host Dan Hunter talks with David Pierce, the chief commercial officer of the legal services firm Axiom. If you would like to share your thoughts on ALSPs or the future of law, then send us an email at futurelawpodcast@gmail.com, or you can get in touch with us via Twitter at the Future Law Pod. Also, if you're enjoying our show, don't hesitate to rate and review us on Apple or Spotify. Thank you to our executive producer and editor, Faria Taherzadeh. Bye for now.